You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Hopefully, if you want to stay healthy, you engage in some form of regular exercise. Experts say that 150 minutes a week, or 5 days of 30 minutes, is essential for good health. It doesn't have to be marathoning or mountain climbing. Good old flat walking can do the trick. We've just got to use those muscles to keep our metabolism going. Perhaps unbeknownst to the vast majority of us that aren't elite athletes, a multi-billion dollar industry has arisen in the sports recovery field. Marketed by famous athletes like LeBron James, Tom Brady, or Stephen Curry, high-performance athletes endorse everything from nutrition bars to various drink concoctions to newer devices that use technology like infrared or salt water or liquid nitrogen, to name a few. My guest today, Christy Ashwanden, is a longtime athlete. She was a state champion runner and became a professional cyclist and cross-country skier. She then became a science journalist and has written for The Washington Post, Outside Magazine, Discover, and Smithsonian. Until recently, she was lead science journalist for the website 538.com. Her new book is called Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery, and it's just out from W.W. Norton. The book is part history, part science, all entertaining and educational, and the author is the lead guinea pig for most of these out-there recovery treatments. Christy Ashwanden is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Christy Ashwanden, welcome to Medical Monday. I want to start first by complimenting you. I really enjoyed the book, Good to Go, and there's a couple things that really impressed me about it. One was that it's very Plimpton-esque, and by that I mean you are both the reporter but also the subject of many of the experiments in the book, and you really put yourself to the test as it sounds like a pretty elite athlete, and you went through a lot of these recovery methods. And the other thing I love about the book is, because I'm sort of a medical skeptic, and it seems like you debunk a lot of these things. So I guess let's just start with, for example, Gatorade, which, you know, has this incredible recognition as like the sports drink, although there are many others now. But you report that we all want to be like Mike, but we don't really need Gatorade necessarily, right?
Right, right. Gatorade, and I mean, we can single out Gatorade because it's the first, but this is sort of universally true about sports drinks. I mean, they're really sort of marketed to us with this notion that we really need electrolytes while we're exercising and after we're exercising, and that these drinks, you know, contain these magical chemicals or, you know, magical contents that are going to help us recover from exercise because, you know, as you're exercising, you're sweating. So you are indeed losing fluid and you lose some salt along with that. And so the idea that is often used to promote these drinks is that, you know, because you're sweating and you're losing both salt and water, you need to replenish this in a sports drink. And there's absolutely some truth to this. As you exercise, you do lose some fluid, particularly if you're sweating heavily. This is why you may notice that you'll get thirsty on a hot day when you're out running or exercising or something like this. But it turns out that it's not actually necessary to consume electrolytes in a drink. Electrolytes is simply the sort of scientific term for salts. And salts are things that we get all the time in our food. And so if you eat a regular meal, eat some of your favorite foods, you will get these things. And it's fine to just drink water. Now, the one sort of exception here is that if you're doing a very long distance event, in that case, it can be helpful to have some carbohydrates and to get some calories into you as you're going to increase, you know, your endurance and performance in these longer distance events. But this is not something that's going to kick in even up to an hour of exercise. We're really talking about longer distances, something like a marathon.
Okay, let's stay with that for a minute because the marathon part was pretty interesting. And for example, I was very intrigued to learn in sort of the recent history part of the book that marathoners used to think that drinking water was actually bad for you or dangerous. So many of these older marathoners, or by that I mean people who ran marathons in, I guess, the 70s when the running craze started to kick off, adamantly refused to drink water. And interestingly, even though they would lose a ton of weight, like sometimes I think you said 8 to 10 pounds during the course of a marathon, there never were really any significant problems with dehydration, which was kind of surprising and counterintuitive.
So what I discovered while researching this book is that dehydration has become sort of a catch-all term. it's something that whenever you have someone collapse in the heat, the first thing that people say is, oh, that person was dehydrated. And often this will even be said by medical personnel, you know, in the initial phases. But when you go and look at sort of the records and look at, you know, things that are actually verified with science or with medicine, it's very rare that dehydration is causing these things. It's not impossible that people are dehydrated. I mean, certainly it happens when you're out there in the heat. But, you know, we're sort of told that this can be life-threatening. In fact, it can. People die of dehydration when they're out in the desert and do not have access to water or fluids. But while I was researching this book, I looked really hard to try and find these cases of people dying on the sports field or dying in marathons from not drinking enough, and I couldn't find a single verified case. Instead, what I did find is at least 5 people who have died from overhydration from a case of this that they acquired during a marathon. So these are people who were following this advice to drink early and often. There's some common advice that's given that says by the time you're thirsty, it's too late. Well, it turns out that that's nonsense. Our bodies have a really sophisticated way of telling us when we need to drink. It's called thirst. It's very important that you pay attention to this and that, you know, it may be very worthwhile to ask yourself during an event or during exercise in the heat, am I feeling thirsty? You know, have I drank anything recently? Is it possible that I'm thirsty? But this idea that you sort of need to choke down water and you need to be constantly drinking is not only misguided, it's dangerous. The medical condition is called hyponatremia. It's also referred to as water intoxication. And it happens when you drink so much that your blood becomes dilute and your brain can swell. And as I said, this can actually be fatal.
You're right. So it's counterintuitive. So not only do you not need to drink as much as, you know, we're often taught that you need to, and in fact, as you pointed out in your research, couldn't find a single case of somebody in a competitive sports event dying of dehydration, but in fact, also counterintuitively, that you can overhydrate. So water intoxication. I was really, I guess, sadly surprised to learn this. Another myth that you busted, well, a couple of them that I particularly wanted to pay attention to, because even sort of armchair athletes, I would put myself in that category. I have always heard about lactic acid. You know,
right.
I'm sore because I worked out and now, you know, whether it's running or playing soccer or, you know, even went to the gym or something and my muscles are sore and I have lactic acid. It's really important that I get the lactic acid out. And you talked about
right.
it. Your high school coach, I think, would say, shake out the lactic acid. Well, I guess your research showed you that, again, not only, I mean, I think our understanding of it was very rudimentary, but in fact, it's probably beneficial.
That's right. So it turns out that your muscles do, in fact, make lactic acid when you're exercising hard, you know, particularly during exercise that's intense. And so that's where we sort of got the notion that, you know, lactic acid was really important. You know, we used to think that it was what made you sore. That was what my high school coach told me, certainly. And this is a notion that's been around for a long time. But it turns out that that's not actually the case. Lactic acid doesn't make you sore. In fact, it can even be a fuel source for working muscles under certain circumstances. The other interesting thing is that it's something that your body actually clears. Your muscles actually clear it quite quickly. And so, you know, there are all of these things that I found that were marketed as, you know, this is something to flush the lactic acid or this will remove lactic acid from your muscles. But it turns out that our muscles do this on their own pretty quickly.
And furthermore, that it seems like it's possible, according to some scientists at least, that the lactic acid may in fact have a beneficial effect. And I guess we could stretch this into the conversation about inflammation, because similar to lactic acid, a lot of times athletes or, you know, whether we consider ourselves athletes or not, will ice ourselves down. And there's a lot more to say about ice and cold. But let's just say ice for the common thing like a sprained ankle, you know, the idea being if you've twisted your ankle, you put some ice on there to, you know, compress it and cool it down so that you minimize inflammation. And so the thinking goes, well, let's minimize the inflammation. It won't swell. And furthermore, we might want to take some non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs to further minimize inflammation. When in fact, when you did the research, maybe you found quite the opposite.
Right. So the idea here is that inflammation is bad, that you want to prevent it, you want to stop it, and that that's going to help you recover from an injury. Or in many cases, you know, this is also pointed to as a way to speed recovery from a hard workout. So your muscles are sore, you know, you want to tamp down any inflammation that might be happening there from a hard workout. But it turns out that this is sort of erroneous thinking, and I'll explain why. Inflammation, sort of the inflammatory process, is your body's way of healing. It's an integral part of the healing process. And so when you go to the gym and lift some heavy weights, The reason you get sore later, and also the reason that you get stronger, is that you're creating this little micro damage in the muscles. So you're creating these little tears. And so what happens is your body goes in and it repairs that damage, and it not only fixes the muscle, but it makes it a little bit stronger for the next time. So it maybe, you know, bolsters those muscle fibers. And that's why, you know, the third or fourth, or even sometimes the second time that you lift that weight, you won't get as sore as you did the first time. This is called the repeat bout effect. But inflammation is an important part of this process. So if you reduce inflammation, you're actually reducing your ability to not only recover from the exercise, but to adapt to it and to get better. These are the things that make us fitter, faster, stronger in response to exercise. And so inflammation is your friend.
Yeah, it was really, I would say, eye-opening to me, because I've always, I mean, and I'm a physician, but I've always been taught, you know, inflammation is bad in a lot of ways. I mean, I know it's great. We think of it as helping in with infections and things like that, where we need our immune system to ramp up. But for athletics, and then certainly in autoimmune conditions, we always think of inflammation as in a way, the enemy. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Christy Ashwanden. She is author of the fabulous new book called Good to Go: What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. Up until recently, Christy was lead science writer at 538, and she's written in numerous other publications, including Outside, Discover, Smithsonian. She was also a former health columnist for the Washington Post. And Christy, in one of the chapters that you title The Perfect Fuel, this goes throughout the book, you talk a lot about nutrition. And there's just a couple of things that were really eye-opening to me. One was that, and this is in no way meant to be an advertisement for McDonald's, but again, in the counterintuitive department, there were a couple of things. One was an experiment that you reported on. It was, again, and it was small, only had a small number of participants. But I think the hypothesis was, if you ate McDonald's, you would have lousy performance. And I'll let you comment on that. But the more interesting and fascinating thing, which I guess I sort of knew, but you'll have to tell us about Usain Bolt, the famous Jamaican world record holder and sprinter, who, in fact, at three different Olympiads, feasted on chicken McNuggets as his high-performance food. I mean, this was crazy, right?
Possibly. I mean, one of the things that I've really concluded doing this research on nutrition, and I've also reported quite widely on nutrition in other contexts. I wrote a story for 538 a few years back. The headline was something like, "You Can't Trust What You Read About Nutrition," that basically explained that nutrition research is really difficult to do. It's difficult to do well. And in part, I think a lot of this comes down to we sort of give food and nutrition, we have this idea that it has supernatural powers. And it is absolutely important to pay attention to what we're putting into our bodies. How we fuel our bodies is really important. But we tend to think that there are foods that are good or bad. We have almost sort of like religious beliefs about some of these things. And oftentimes, particularly among athletes who are burning lots of calories, you know, they basically have this really hot fire. It doesn't really matter so much exactly what's being put into there as long as it's, you know, fuel to keep that fire going. And so it is absolutely important to have a balanced diet and to be getting all of the nutrients that you need, and fruits and vegetables and all of these things we've been told are definitely good. But at the end of the day, what Usain Bolt needs when he's at the Olympics is fuel to continue doing this very high intensity exercise that he's doing. He's at the Olympic Village. He's worried about eating strange foods that might upset his stomach. He knows that he likes chicken McNuggets. You know, his system handles them fine. And so, you know, he feasts on these things. It's what fueled all of these gold medals that he got. Does that mean that it's the absolute perfect fuel for everybody? Absolutely not. I think the bottom line here, though, is that it's important to sort of have an overall good diet. Worrying on the level of each meal that you eat perfectly, or that this food is good and this food is bad, can really make you sort of focus on the wrong thing and can cause a lot of athletes undue stress.
Well, and it's you spend a considerable amount of time pointing this out, that it seems like many athletes really do, in fact, obsess about the breakdown of what they're going to eat and then when they're going to eat it after a performance. And by that, I mean,
Absolutely.
Well, they think, oh, I need this much protein and this much carbohydrate. And I guess early on in these days, it was like no fat at all. But now, in fact, we know that you know, well-balanced diets are probably important. So you give one example. I can't remember who the athlete was, but I think it was
a story about this, actually.
Oh, go for it.
There's actually an athlete from Oklahoma who's in the book in numerous places. She's almost sort of the hero of the book because she really is someone who has just managed to master recovery. It's something that she's really good at. She probably has a natural talent for it, but it's also something that she's really figured out for herself. And the thing about Camille, so she is a multiple world record holder endurance ultra marathoner. So she holds the record for the fastest 100-mile run. And I just want to point out, this is not the fastest female 100-mile. She has the fastest time on the registered course of any human being, which is really awesome. But she is someone who, after one of these hard runs, she doesn't worry about, you know, eating a specific, you know, packaged food or weighing things out or, you know, figuring out the exact nutrients. She sort of asks herself, what sounds good to me right now? What am I hungry for? In fact, in one of her recent 100-mile, I think it was during her world record for the most miles run in 24 hours, this is on a track in Arizona, she actually was asking for Taco Bell, which we don't always think of as the healthiest food, but it worked and it fueled her. And I'll just point out that in this kind of situation, she's burning so much energy, she just needs to keep that fire going.
Part of this chapter was, of course, I guess, the history of Power Bar, which I didn't really recognize as the very first sort of nutrient or athletic-specific performance bar. But then it all ties in neatly kind of with your story about how you were a performance athlete. I don't know if this was at the part of your life where you were a runner on the ski team or no, actually it was cycling, I think. You've done many different sports. And so you talked about how it was like a very important status symbol in a way to be sponsored by Power Bar or be able to get these things for free because in the early days, I think they were pretty pricey and you could only get them, I guess, through mail order maybe. You told the story of the inventors who it was a very kind of homemade formula that they just kind of kept tinkering with for about 3 years with their friends. And of course, now we have all kinds of gels available and you know, you go to a running store or just to buy some shoes and you're just inundated with the possibilities. And of course, I don't need to mention online or catalogs, all these things you can get. So it's really become an industry unto itself. I want to turn to some of the more maybe out there types of recovery modalities, as you call them. One that popped up in the book, you had a chapter on calming the senses. And that was interesting to me because I'd done a story, and we have a local research scientist at a place called the Laureate Institute for Brain Research who studies floating as a treatment for for anxiety and depression. And so I had never really, I guess he did mention to me that Stephen Curry, the famous basketball player, and other elite athletes have used or attested to their floating and enhancing their prowess. But you said you have a very fast mind thinking all the time and you didn't like being in the floating pod because you were fairly claustrophobic. But it sounds like it kind of won you over in the end.
It did. You know, you mentioned earlier that I did all these things. I did a lot of guinea pigging for this book. And yeah, although the book isn't really about me, I do. There were many times when I needed to sort of get in there for myself and try these things out so I could sort of explain what it was like. And so, yeah, I went into the float tank. And I should just mention what this is. It's basically a very small pod that's dark and quiet. There's no noise, really, and no light. And there are just a few inches of water, but it's very salty water. So your body is extremely buoyant. And the idea here is that you're just going to float in this water and sort of let your mind wander. And what I sort of came to think of it as is forced meditation. And it's forced meditation for monkey minds like mine. And so I went into this thinking, I'm just going to hate it. I'm a little bit claustrophobic. I mean, you basically close yourself in this small little area. It's dark. But what I found is that I really loved it. And what I loved about it is it shut out every other thing. It just really, you know, put yourself in your own mind and your own body. And I found it extremely relaxing. In fact, it's something that I've continued to do fairly regularly, even after I finished the book.
Do you think it enhances your athletic performance or just your ability to concentrate or relaxation as it may be?
So here's the thing. Recovery, one of the most important components of recovery is something that I think athletes just commonly make this mistake of not giving it its due. And what I'm talking about here is sort of the psychological aspect of recovery. So to your body, stress is stress, whether it's coming from your workout and your exercise or whether it's coming from the things that we normally just call stress, you know, life stress, your stressful job, the stress at home, whatever it is that's giving you, you know, what we commonly refer to as stress. These things also tax your body. And so if you're not managing your stress, you're not really giving yourself full recovery. And so if you're an athlete who is trying to enhance recovery, you're trying to, you know, improve your readiness so you're ready to, you know, you're good to go for your next workout, you need to find some sort of way to address the stress in your life. So some sort of way to rest and relax. You know, because at its most basic level, that's what recovery is. It's rest and relaxation. And so for me, I found floating very relaxing. I found it to be a really great way of managing stress. But the thing that's magic about this isn't, you know, something about the salt water or what I'm doing here. It's that I'm finding a way to sort of check out from all these stressful things in my life. It's that I'm finding a way to relax. And so for me, floating was that thing. But there, you know, other people will have other things. And I don't want to present this as the be-all and end-all. You know, I think it's really important that athletes find some sort of ritual and some sort of way to manage the stress in their life. It can be floating. It may be something else. You know, for me, this was a really effective way of doing that. But the thing that makes it work is just that it's reducing stress. It's quieting my mind. It's helping me, like, really fully relax my body. And so, you know, for some people, that may be taking a hot shower. It may be traditional forms of meditation. Some people like yoga, for instance. So the exact way that you're doing that is less important than just the fact that you are relaxing.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Christy Ashwanden, who is the author of the new book, Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. Christy was, up until very recently, lead science writer at 538. And Christy, let's look at some of the experimental recovery tools. For example, there were these pajamas I can't really quite understand that had something to do with Tom Brady, where I guess they're made of a special fabric and they somehow claim to retain your body's heat, but then send the heat internally into your organs or some claim like that?
Yeah, the claims are sort of nonsensical. It was that they contained some sort of special powder that released far infrared radiation, which is just sort of a way of saying that it's taking your body heat and sort of reflecting it back in a certain wavelength. Tom Brady claims that these pajamas were key to his performance. Let's keep in mind that he was a famous football player before these pajamas existed, but you know, maybe they've helped him since then. You know, he is getting up in the years. I did try them out. I didn't find any magical powers, but I will say one thing. Tom Brady is absolutely right about sleep. You know, he's sort of someone who's famous for prioritizing sleep. He supposedly goes to bed very early every night, and this is a good idea. In all of my research, I found that sleep is the most potent recovery tool known to science. And so any athlete who really cares about recovery should be prioritizing sleep. That's the number one thing you can do. In fact, it's probably the number two and three and four and five and six. Nothing else that I looked into even came close.
And I think you at one point mentioned, I think in the chapter on sleep, that it is the only thing that correlated to performance, at least in one study or one meta-analysis, that sleep was the only thing that seemed to predict future performance. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that was true of a coach that I talk about who kept track of a lot of different metrics among his runners for a season, possibly two, I can't remember now, but had looked at all these things, and sleep was the one thing that could predict how well they would perform, both in a workout, you know, in practice, but also in a meet.
Okay, another modality is, there's really two, I guess, but they're related, the ice bath, which I guess LeBron James, probably the most famous basketball player, has made famous. He stands in an ice bath. I saw a video of him and Dwayne Wade when they played together going into the ice bath. And then you tried out this thing where you use liquid nitrogen in the air. You get in kind of a tank and they infuse liquid nitrogen into the tank around you, and you supposedly get an ultra quick cool, but you sort of point out that the science of it is a little bit spurious, that the ice bath is actually probably much colder and much more painful, in fact. And yet neither one, the people you interview in the book, don't seem to put much stock in it. Not the purveyors of it, but the scientists who study it.
Right. I mean, I think that the reason cryotherapy has gotten popular is that although it is painful, it's about 2.5 minutes, whereas an ice bath usually lasts a lot longer and it's much colder. You know, although the liquid nitrogen, you know, itself is colder, your body doesn't get as cold. Yeah, I tried this out. It's basically like standing naked in a blizzard. It's that cold, but it's also very brief. And I noticed, too, that after doing it, you sort of get out of there and feel like you're ready to kick some butt. It's definitely an adrenaline rush, which may explain some of the popularity as well. But thinking a little bit about ice baths and what they're purported to do, this goes back to the whole idea of inflammation. And so the cell on ice baths for the most part is that they're going to reduce inflammation. But, you know, we just talked about inflammation is sort of a necessary part. If you're wanting to recover and to respond to your training, you want that inflammation. But it's also true that icing only, it doesn't prevent inflammation. It just sort of slows it down and stops it temporarily. You get out of the cold bath and whatever was going on before proceeds again. So it's not something that's having a long-term effect. Although there was a study I referred to in the book where they did an interesting thing. They took some volunteers and they put them on a training program. And then what they did, this is a strength training program, they iced one limb but not the other. And interestingly enough, they found that the limb that was iced made fewer gains, had lesser increase in strength. There was something with protein going on as well where they weren't sort of building the muscle as well. So it does seem to be potentially detrimental in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. It's like here was in situ evidence, in vivo evidence from the same person showing one arm versus the other or one limb versus the other. Christy, I want to turn for a second to your background. And you're like the perfect person to write this book, a combination of a science journalist and an elite athlete. So let me get this straight. You were a national champion runner in high school who became both a professional cyclist and then professional or a high-grade cross-country skier. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I wasn't a national champion runner. I was a state champion runner in high school. Then I ran Division I until I got injured, which is how I started cycling, and I learned to cross-country ski. And so things sort of went from there. I was on an elite cycling team I was on my college cycling team. We were collegiate champions. And then I was on an elite team, cycling team after that. But then I went on to be a cross-country skier, a professional there, which was probably the sport I did at the highest level. I lived in Europe and lived and raced and traveled all over Europe and North America racing.
So what we need is a triathlon with running, cycling, and cross-country skiing, not with the swimming part, right? Or I guess they have biathlon or the one where you shoot and ski, right? I guess you don't do guns or whatever. That's probably okay. But it's really made you the perfect person because it sounds like, I mean, if you read the book carefully, you're still someone who works out quite a bit. And you talk about running, I can't remember the name of the run, but up and down this mountain in Colorado.
Yeah.
It's just... I guess let's conclude by asking you, what is your go-to recovery method? It sounds like sleep is probably pretty important and nutrition is important, but not necessarily specific. But I'll let you tell us, what is it you best like to do, and does it depend on the type of workout?
It depends a little bit on the type of workout, but I like to just put my feet up at the end of the day, crack open a bottle of wine, have a glass. You know, the trick is that you stop at one. But just relax. I like to have a ritual with my husband, have friends over, but just sort of put aside all of the stresses of the day, all of the worries, cares, et cetera, and just sort of take some time to relax. I also really love, we have some hot springs around where I live, so I enjoy doing that when I get a chance. But yeah, that's sort of it. And I really prioritize sleep. I think that's probably the most important and consistent thing that I do is that I make really, really certain to get, I usually get about 8 to 8.5 hours of sleep every night.
Wow. The book is totally entertaining and very educational as well. I learned a lot, and I'm someone who likes sports, but almost knew nothing about the recovery industry. So I think you have definitely put your finger on something that is growing in the U.S., and growing in popularity and definitely has a faddish sort of affiliation with it. The name of the book is Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. It's just out from Norton, and it was by my guest today, Christy Ashwand. And Christy, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on the book.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.